Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Zero Poverty Act Now. Find out about a Caritas campaign to combat the hidden forms of poverty across our European continent. And bringing faith to bear on the world of banking, investments and the financial sector. We hear from one American Catholic priest about why these are issues that should concern us all. The Secretary General of Caritas Internationalis, Leslie Ann Knight, has been appointed as one of the ambassadors of the European Union's Year for Combating Poverty and Social Exclusion. 2010 has in fact been designated the focus of a continent-wide campaign to challenge stereotypes and raise awareness about the many different faces of poverty in our so-called developed countries. As part of that campaign earlier this year, the Brussels-based Caritas Europa launched its own effort to tackle poverty and social exclusion with a petition to be presented to European institutions calling for concrete changes to guarantee decent living conditions for all people on the continent. The Caritas campaign is ambitiously entitled Zero Poverty Act Now. With its own website, www.zeropoverty.org, aimed, it says, at anyone who agrees with the statement, poverty is a scandal.
And I think we have really to reflect about a new way to do economy, to build our society.
Father Ernie Gillen is president of Caritas Europa. I sat down with him to find out more about this year's anti-poverty campaign in Europe and about a recent call to European governments to live up to their commitments to the developing world as well.
The campaign Zero Poverty was launched by Caritas Europa in order to raise awareness within Caritas organizations all over Europe, but also within the citizens in Europe, that poverty is a reality. We cannot close our eyes, not looking at poverty as it presents itself today. So what we did in that poverty paper, we are presenting three different instruments to analyze poverty, because a lot of people are asking, what is poverty? And then you can go from extreme poverty to the statistical poverty threshold lying within 60% of the median under which people are considered to be poor. So in the first instrument, we are trying to give an answer that poverty is a multidimensional phenomena and that you cannot reduce poverty to the material poverty. We know that loneliness, for example, is a big issue within elderly people, within people living in prisons, people living on the street. Some children today are very lonely. And the Holy Father, in his encyclical Caritas in Veritate, he was pointing out very clearly in one of the articles that loneliness might be one of the biggest issues when it comes to poverty today.
So it's a much more holistic vision than simply looking at the statistics.
That's true, because we know that today there are people, for example, who during a whole week do not have any social contact at all. When you are talking to people in Georgia, for example, they only have one contact with the home care service person from Caritas joining them once a week. The same is true for Azerbaijan or for other countries, but even in Germany or even in France, you have cases reported that elderly people have only once a week a contact with another person. And that's not about material poverty, but that's about personal relational poverty, not to speak about the spiritual poverty.
It's such a complex problem, though. How do you go about proposing solutions to so many different facets of the issue?
For us, it's very important to make people understand that it's a citizens' issue first and a state issue on the second phase. So each person can do something, and we cannot simply refer the poverty solutions to the governments or to the states, but we want to raise awareness in our societies, in our communities, that they are able to bring solutions to people in need. They simply have to open their eyes and look, are there people around? Talk to people, accepting that every person is a human being, whether that person is living in the street, whether that's a person living with a handicap, whether that's a person coming from abroad, but that we are losing as humanity if we are losing a single person.
As you say, Pope Benedict himself wrote extensively about this issue in his encyclical. He also went in person, didn't he? He put his words into action, as it were, and went to visit a hostel run by Caritas here in Rome. What kind of reaction did you find that came about because of that?
I had the privilege to be present personally during that encounter here in Rome. And I saw some tears in the eyes of the homeless people, for example, when the Pope entered, when he was talking to those people, when he was listening very carefully what that lady told him about her whole story when she was living for more than 20 years on the street. And I think that he was not only carefully listening, but that he was giving back some type of empathy, some type of solidarity, and all those people from the Termini station, they were really very moved when they had the opportunity to meet him. On the other hand, it was even possible to make an example in such a way that more than 100 bishops all over Europe did the same. So the action of the Pope meeting people in need was followed but by more than 100 other diocesan bishops all over Europe. And we have plenty of testimonies coming from people who met bishops and bishops who met people in need. What is interesting, people in need, they were saying, that's interesting to talk to a bishop, because some bishops, they are very alone as well. So there was a kind of solidarity coming from that community back to the bishop, saying they are people in need, so to say, as well. And so they met in person. On the other way, it came back as a feedback from some bishops as well, that they were saying, isn't it interesting to meet people to whom you can speak directly? Because that's one of the advantages, talking to people who are poor. They have no time for diplomacy, so they have to go straight. If they want to talk about God, they will talk about God immediately and not first talk about the weather and then talking about other issues and then slowly introducing maybe the subject of faith or God. But that's one of the big advantages, talking to people who we call poor.
Specifically at the question of the materially poor, those who really are living in extremely difficult conditions. It's true in Europe today we have a new category, the new poor, as we call them, people who in the past would simply never have had recourse to the services of Caritas, for example.
No, if you look at the economic and financial crisis we are facing in Europe and all over the world, then we are talking about the working poor. For example, there are a lot of people who are working daily, but the income they get for their work is not enough to survive in our very expensive environment. So that's a reality. Then you have a lot of people who lost their job. In Spain, for example, you have more than 20% of people without a job. That's enormous. So we have a new category of people entering into poverty who are highly skilled people, who are people willing to contribute to the common good in our society, but who are no longer allowed to do. So we have to reflect about different economics as well. There's one type of economy we call the solidarian economy. The Pope, he was quoting that in his encyclical as well, and he was referring to the gratitudinous, so being a gift and using a gift as a possibility within economy. And I think we have really to reflect about a new way to do economy, to build our society, not only earning money, but giving services to the community, in the community. So this might change even the paradigm for economical work.
This is a particularly Christian vision. How much do you think this kind of idea can be a practical reality for the politicians, the policy makers?
I think it's more than a very Christian idea. It's a very human idea, because a lot of people are aware that they are instrumentalized in the current economy. So they don't want to be instrumentalized. And even our human rights are a very forceful instrument to show people, to make people aware that they should not instrumentalize other people. And of course, being not instrumentalized by other people or by other entities. So in this regard, I think it's a very universal idea to really leave this technical world and to go for a more human world.
In a time of financial crisis, though, when the leaders are trying to make the numbers meet, what kind of reception do you think this idea can have?
Nowadays, for example, Amartya Sen, Stiglitz and Fitoussi, two of them being Nobel Prize persons, they have developed a new instrument to measure the well-being. And measuring well-being cannot be done in a way we did it until now, just looking for the GDP. So they have presented a report to the French President Sarkozy, and that was received by the European Union as well. Now all the statistics in the world are trying to elaborate new instruments to measure the well-being. And if we are going for new instruments to measure well-being, this will change dramatically the framework of our perception. So, for example, when we only measured the GDP, Luxembourg, the country I'm coming from, was number 1. When then they added the Human Development Index, we suddenly were only number 17. Because education in a lot of other countries was much better than in Luxembourg. So the instruments we are utilizing to measure wealth, to measure well-being, might change our perception. So it's interesting to follow that work of Sen and Stiglitz and Fitoussi.
Caritas has also just recently issued a new demand or a new request to governments to live up to the commitments on the Millennium Development Goals. We only have another 5 years to go. We don't look as though we're really on track in many areas.
No, it's very clear that we are running out of time when it comes to the Millennium Development Goals. And for the time being, I think it's very important to accept that the curve for the Millennium Goals has to go on. So it's now the time to reflect which type of commitment do we need for beyond 2015, because we know that it was a good instrument. It was one of the first times in the UN history where you had clear indicator you could measure, and there were only 8 goals put forward and not hundreds and hundreds of different goals. So having a very small framework where everybody can use all over the world, that's a helpful way to proceed. So we think it's now the time to begin to reflect how to continue that commitment the heads of state took in 2000 when they signed that Millennium Declaration.
What do you hope can be the biggest achievements of this plan? You say it was a very good idea. The instrument itself was very successful. How much has it actually achieved, though, for the poor of our world?
We know better how many poor people are existing in the different countries. We know that we did not succeed to reduce poverty at the level we agreed it should be reduced. So in that regard, it's a knowledge given to the international community, and we are facing our own commitments. And I think that's important, because if human people are making a commitment to the whole world, and this is what they did in the Millennium Declaration, then it should not be to come up with a new proposal and forgetting about the old commitments. And so having a time frame of 15 years with clear indicators, even so we failed, but at least we have to acknowledge that we had an idea not to fail, and then to analyze the causes why we failed in that, and why perhaps we have to change some indicators, but not now going for a complete new instrument, but really continuing with that instrument and requesting statistical analysis, so that we are not lying into our own pockets, as we say, but really facing the truth when it comes to the reality of poverty.
One of the underlying ideas behind the MDGs was that reducing poverty, increasing development is a benefit not just to the poor but also to the rich, in that it increases global stability. Do you think this idea has really got through or not?
I'm not sure. Let's say the 8th millennium goal is about international partnership. And I think the Global Forum, for example, is one answer from the civil society, where people are meeting in the World Social Forum or in the European and African Social Forum. And if you are looking at all those different fora, then you can see that a lot of Christian people are the builders and the drivers in those fora. And I think that's a real achievement, that we brought people together worldwide to talk and to share about their situations, because what is specific in our globalized world is that the North is in the South and the South is in the North. So we cannot make that divide. We thought you have the North and you have the South. And this is only possible if you bring people together, so that they are becoming aware that there are very rich people living in Argentina, there are very rich people living in the Democratic Republic of Congo, there are of course very poor people living in London, there are very poor people living in Berlin. And making us aware as human beings that it's not an issue between countries, it's not an issue between rich and poor, but it's a matter for people. And we have to be careful not to be put into an ideology where suddenly we have the impression that we are the rich and others will have the impression we are the poor, and then building conflicts which are very bad for the evolution of our own humanity.
Thanks there to Father Ernie Gillen, President of Caritas Luxembourg and the Brussels-based Caritas Europa. Of high finance, investment banking, or the stock market are not normally considered essential areas of expertise for priests and religious. In fact, the very idea of vast sums of money swirling around in a virtual world 24 hours a day is enough to make many people switch off altogether, unless they have a background in economics or financial affairs. Yet putting faith principles back into finance and banking is exactly the business of one American Catholic priest who heads the Justice, Peace and Integrity of Creation Office for the Oblates of Mary Immaculate in Washington, D.C. Father Seamus Finn's many responsibilities include things like past president of the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility and executive committee member of the International Interfaith Investment Group. Travelling around the world to countries where the Oblates are based, he's spent the past two decades encouraging religious institutes to invest wisely and to engage with corporations on a wide variety of human rights and environmental concerns. In the following reflection, Father Seamus talks about why people of faith can and should bring their values to bear on the financial sector.
Clearly, one of the issues and one of the concerns that continues to emerge as in the discussion of the engagement of people of faith with the world, with society, with people, is understanding the ways in which our lives are organized. And one of the important things that has obviously increased immensely or grown immensely in this is the financial sector. Whereas if we may have come from a more agrarian, more rural, more simple society in our background, and there was lots of bartering and lots of trading and lots of going to the local market and purchasing things and exchanging things, the financial services sector has become such a huge part of the economy. And it's done that over a very short period of time, that things like banks and insurance companies and home mortgages and pensions, all those things have just become so much a part of daily life. And they've then taken one of the ways I think that people communicated at the local level and institutionalized it and formalized it. And in some ways, some would say, in fact, impersonalized it. So I guess one looks then as to say, if I am a Catholic and I'm trying to be faithful to my beliefs, how does that impact the way that I use money or that I use resources or assets? And what is the impact of the way that I use those things on others? Because in reality, once we enter into this financial services sector, there are many other people participating as well. If it's at the local bank and I go and deposit money, we know that the bank then takes the money and lends it to somebody else, either to purchase something or to finance something. So one wonders sometimes, what criteria are, what onerous conditions, or is it helpful, the conditions under which the money is lent? So that's just a small example, I think, of whereas previously a parent might lend money to a child, or a neighbor might lend money to a neighbor. Now there's this intermediary between us, and it's called the financial services sector. And it operates, as I think the amazing thing about this is that it operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You ask somebody, how is the market going today? And now they're going to ask you, do you mean the market in China or in Hong Kong or the one in New York or Frankfurt? Because the one in China is already closed, so we know how that worked out. So I think getting our heads around the reality of the fact that this financial system is operating constantly and we are stepping in and out of it as individuals, as families, as communities, as institutions, we're a part of it. And so I think it's important to try and be clear in our participation in this system. What kind of ethical and moral principles or guidance are we applying to the way in which we participate? Or is it just everyone for themselves? And whoever survives comes out ahead. So I think it's important, therefore, for people of faith to try and say, how do I take the commandment to love my neighbor as myself and apply that to the way that I act in the financial system? What is the impact of, I think, one of the other great recognitions of late has been in this financial services sector, what is the impact on the environment or what is the impact on the earth? We've recognized clearly that it's an exhaustible system, so that we can abuse it. We can pollute the air, we can pollute water, we can spill chemicals, we can dispose of things carelessly in the environment that can have very long-term impact. So if it is that the river is polluted and now it needs to be cleaned up, there's a cost associated with that. And we may at one point have said, well, that's the cost of doing business and we don't need to pay attention to it. It'll be passed on to future generations. I think we're very clear now that it is a whole earth system. And anything, any way in which we despoil the earth, it has an impact on our lives, on the lives of our children, and on communities to come. So, in other words, we need to count the cost of all of these things. And so I think one of the realities is I think that people of faith are quite often put off by finance. But maybe they're put off because I sometimes think it's because it's so many numbers and it's percentages, and maybe we didn't like math when we were in school, and it's reading a financial sheet is just something that we can't get our heads around. And I want to clearly suggest, I think it is a specialized area, but so isn't theology, and so isn't medicine, and so aren't all the other things that make such an important contribution to the world. So that I think people of faith don't need to be economists, and we all don't need to be experts, but we do, I think, need to ask, you know, some basic questions. What's the economy for? What does it do to people? How do people participate in it? Is it helpful in the local community? Or, you know, are all the people in the local community depositing their money in the bank, and is the bank taking the money and lending it in some foreign country or investing it poorly? So I think there are some very simple questions like that that we can begin to ask that help us to understand how the system works, how it impacts the local community, and then what are some of the ways in which we can perhaps change the way the system works, because I think most now would say that this system is built on a continuous model of growth and consumption without always taking account of the fact that the resources we have are limited. And given any number of different changes that are going on in the world, we have to be much more careful. We have to be much more careful about the environment. We have to be much more careful about the kind of food security issues or water issues, because if not, we end up actually damaging seriously, you know, that creation that is given to us as a gift, that's entrusted to us for our own health and our own growth, but also for the health and the growth and the future of many generations to come.
My thanks there to Father Seamus Finn, head of the Justice, Peace and Integrity of Creation Office for the Oblates of Mary Immaculate in Washington, D.C. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.